You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, hello, Tamara here, your host, and the person that refuses to get her eyes checked, but has readers in every room of the house. I should probably formalize that and go to a doctor about my eyes. But, you know, I like all the colors of the different readers. They're fun to buy. Okay, this podcast is brought to you by Brility Digital, who applies strategic thinking to your company's growth objectives, and then uses what they find to identify opportunities others miss in order to help drive your company's growth. Now, don't forget to listen to my interview with Brility partway through. Value bombs all the way. So do you ever wonder what it takes to shine in a way that lifts others around you too? I mean, let's face it, being able to inspire the people you work with to take action, or maybe to take on a new project, or to say yes to buy into your new idea, that's the key to innovation and the key to success. So with that, I interviewed Paresh Shah, founder of the Lifters Academy, working with lifters that elevate their teams and even organizations. And here's the cool part. Doesn't matter what your age is, where you live, your title, how long you've been working, that's not what determines if you are a lifter. What determines that is you do. The other thing you'll find interesting about Paresh, which I was really struck by, was his great, vast, very diverse experience. And you'll see how he uses that to come together to drive his work and to really fuel his thinking. Okay, let's do this.
Paresh, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Tamara. Really happy to be here with you.
So I always love asking this question because you never know what you're going to find. Tell me about your favorite innovative brand or business and why.
There's a coffee place here in Manhattan Beach, Los Angeles area. It's called the Two Guns Coffee. And the people there are just amazing. They're what we call lifters. They're just all positive, super creative, love their jobs, very innovative. And I go there when I want an extra dose of creative inspiration. And they always deliver, including the perfect Halloween costume that they nudged me into doing. And, you know, one of your quotes, I think, is I'll try anything once. So they made me, they gave me the courage to have a great Halloween costume, which I thought my kids would be so embarrassed about. And they found a way for me to pull it off in a way where it was epic. And so it's a group called Two Guns. And I had the best Halloween costume with my wife, you know, one of those joint Halloween costumes.
You can't leave us hanging. You have to tell us what the costume was. Come on now.
I know. So we have four kids, and you know, usually when they're little, you have that little pumpkin Halloween costume that the kids wear. So my wife had a pumpkin costume, and I said, all right, well, let's do some kind of a mashup, right? I'm an innovation guy. There's got to be something great. And so what I came up with was to print out at Kinko's a big McCormick spice.
Pumpkin spice.
So it'd be pumpkin spice. So that was the start of it. And then I went to Two Guns to get my mocha with oat milk. And I said, hey, let's jam on this. And what I'd really like to do is, you know, take it to another level. And what we ended up with was so epic. Basically, I ended up being, and it was a subtle thing. So at first it's like, what are you? Wait a minute, pumpkin spice? Oh, we get it. But then there was a whole different level, which, as you know, in innovation, there's always like that other level.
Yeah.
And I pulled off being all of the Spice Girls.
Oh my God.
At the same time. So I was Posh Spice and I had a soccer ball.
Oh my God.
Because of David Beckham. I had red, white, and blue socks, like Sporty Spice.
Yeah.
I had a big afro for Scary Spice. And it was, and I had the red, white, and blue, the British logo. So I basically pulled off off Victoria Beckham and scary and sporty with the cool tennis shoes. And it wasn't embarrassing. My kids actually didn't get it, which was perfect. Because I was going to go as like, you know, the Spice Girls, you know, with the little clips in my, you know, get a wig with the little clips in my hair. But that's
so much better.
Banned me from being the father of my four children. So.
Oh my gosh, that's way more creative than I thought you were going to tell me you had a latte in each hand. Because then you with your wife would be pumpkin spice lattes. Right, which is like all the ridiculous craze in October, which I never understand. It's not my thing. So I'm like, why are people so crazy about pumpkin spice lattes? But yeah. I think yours takes it to a whole different place. And I'm really hoping
it's
not.
Delivered that. I was afraid that I would get, you know, disbanded, whatever, you know, abused by my children, embarrass them. And they said, no, Paresh, you can do it. You're awesome. You can do it. And then we jammed. And in 5 minutes, we had it. We had the afro, and I had that red, white, and blue, and I had the basketball. And I had a lion thing for, I don't know, which one is that? Scary Spice?
I'm not sure.
I can't keep them apart, tell them apart. But anyway, I was the Spice Girls, and my wife and I were Pumpkin Spice, and we rocked it on Halloween.
Oh my God, that's
thanks
amazing.
Thanks to the Two Guns Coffee in here in South Bay and in Los Angeles. They're amazing, super creative, very innovative, and they're lifters, very positive people. You just go in and you come out elevated in your vibration.
Oh my gosh, that's wonderful. I can see why you love them so much. And you are living my dream of coordinated family outfits. Nobody in my house will do it with me. It is my vision. One day I'm going to make it happen. That's so great. I actually want to ask you actually another personal question, really. In your bio, it says that really you're everything from a serial entrepreneur to an engineer to a yogi, which, first of all, are things you don't normally see on the same line. But second, I'm just curious from your perspective how having a broad range of interests or skills has helped you succeed in business, be more innovative.
Well, I was listening to one of your podcasts with Kelly McDonald.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And you're talking about, you know, the power of diversity, and you can't be thinking the same all the time. Diversity in thinking is really where innovation comes from. I run an innovation company, and a lot of what we're about, as you do as well, is, you know, this whole aspect of intersection thinking. And so we take it to another level. You know, often it's about intersection thinking, bringing different worlds together, right, from different industries, from different experiences. And what I try to embody to the best of my ability is not just intersection thinking as I go around the world and give keynotes and kind of see all – I get invited to the coolest stuff around the world. I bet you do as well.
It's amazing what there's groups for. Who knew, you know?
It's so fun. So what I found in my journey, and it's an unfolding one, is there's intersection thinking, which is – and then there's intersection being. And what I have found in this, what sounds like a disparate group of interests, right? I'm a business strategist, I'm an innovation junkie, I'm a trainer, I'm a coach, I'm a yoga, meditation yogi, and I'm an engineer. And what I've found, and frankly, it's been a bit of a struggle integrating these pieces as I've evolved, is let's be an intersection being. And like, let's embody that. And that's where the greatest ideas come from is, hey, you know what? There's this thing from this far corner over here that's part of who I am. And there's this other thing that's in this other corner, which is, you know, the boardroom guy. And let's bring those together, kind of like that pumpkin spice thing, in a way that can, you know, really take our clients' performance or my students' performance in life, if it's, you know, wisdom and, you know, life stuff, to a whole new levels. And so it's been a challenge because there's these different parts of you to go, well, how do I reconcile that? In fact, when I first became a yogi and a yoga teacher and a meditation and mindfulness junkie, for lack of a better word, and somehow I've been very gifted because it's not me, I'm just an instrument. I actually was hiding that from my Harvard Business School friends because I felt embarrassed about that. And then in my yoga classes, you know, they didn't know like all this other stuff. They were like, oh, Paresh, you know, the yogi. And I was hiding these different aspects of who I was. And then as time has gone by, I've integrated them because I've been permissioned to. People are like, oh, it's so cool how you can apply that to, you know, innovation or product development or team motivation, or vice versa, taking business things and bringing it, you know, a lot of the kind of self-help, spiritual work is often very, you know, kind of elevated, conceptual, and we're able to go, hey, this is return on invested capital. Okay, let's talk about bottom line stuff. And so it helps ground. So that's basically how do we integrate these? You be an intersection being, and you find those aspects of you that just are willing, that they want to get out there and thrive, and let them thrive, and then find ways to start interlinking them. And it's a really beautiful, beautiful process. Sometimes it's very painful and embarrassing because we mess up and we kind of swing wildly sometimes in when we first discover these parts of who we are. And then it becomes this vortex, which just feeds on itself, where that's what people want now. They want that keynote speaker or that teacher who can relate to the practical, the self-help, the spiritual, the bottom line stuff. And that's a lot of inner work, really, ultimately, that I encourage, you know, my clients and students to do is, you know, find those aspects, those, you know, weird, different parts of who you are, and find a way to bring them into who you are, because that's where the greatest innovation blossoms.
So I want to dig into a few things that what you said. I'm just kind of taking notes. One is being an intersection being versus just intersection thinking. Is the distinction there that it's beyond just a point in time exercise, like I go into a brainstorm session and I'm like, how do these things mash together, versus kind of living it every day? And is it just about is it about opening up those doors in yourself to like connect all the rooms? Or is it about going out and saying, hey, I'm going to go get a diverse set of experiences and bring them all together? And maybe those aren't or questions. They're probably not mutually exclusive, now that I say it out loud. But yeah, what is the distinction there?
Okay, so I'm going to answer the second question first, Tamara, which is, it's a great way that you've phrased it. Yes, it's opening those doors to these chambers of who we are. And in the sort of the self-help consciousness work, ultimately, I'm a consciousness guru or a consciousness junkie. I wouldn't call myself a guru. I'm a junkie. So what we found is there's a process in our own unfoldment as human beings, and it's a process called the metanoic process, metanoia, which is the transformation. And the way it's described is that self-examination of the compartmentalized ways of being, and the laboratory of our inner mind and our inner self. And when we have that self-awareness to do that metanoic process and examine those what they call the compartmentalized ways of being, to me, those are those different rooms. And when you talk about opening the doors, that's a perfect metaphor for actually, you know, basically breaking down those walls between these different compartmentalized aspects of who we are. Some of them are actually hidden from ourselves, and connecting, opening the doors. And ultimately, the doors are part of walls, and then just removing the walls so that there isn't even any distinction, where one can easily flow through, you know, between these different rooms. And ultimately, it's one room. It's who I am, or who my client is, or who the CEO is. And how do you bring that to bear without these distinctions between these different aspects? So that's that's an answer to your first question. I love that idea of the doors between these different rooms. It's a great metaphor.
Thanks. Well, and I also, just as you were talking, it's kind of what came to my head, but it also kind of made me realize how we shut doors. Like, so we walk into the office and we're that person, and then we walk into the house and we're this person, and then the weekend hits, right? And 5 o'clock on Friday and we're this person. And what a shame it is, what a disservice we're doing ourselves by compartmentalizing our lives that way versus just making it all one. And it kind of reminds me how, you know, I think for the longest time, I don't buy into this, but for the longest time we are told, right, don't bring your emotions to work. That's not, the work is not where you do that. But I think, first of all, great innovation comes out of emotion. And second,
no doubt, that your emotions and feelings and the great wonders of innovation just spring forth.
Yeah, I think so. And I just think that it means you're cutting off a whole part of yourself. So as you were saying that, I was just thinking through, like, how do you pull it all together? But what I appreciate about it is you're not saying go be something else and add that to your life. Just take all those rooms or chambers of who you are and put them together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the things when I'm coaching executives, a lot of the issues that we confront in terms of their performance at work and how to amp up their performance from great to super great is this idea, and I dispel this as quickly as I can. They say, oh, Paresh, you know, I want to perform greater at work. I want to be a greater transformational leader. I want to inspire my people. I want to be able to inspire new innovation. But I have, work-life balance is a real problem. Can you help me with that? And one of the first things that I tell my clients is, if you make it a work-life balance and you phrase it as that and you see it as that, you're pretty much screwed.
Right. That's like a bad teeter-totter.
You're screwed. Exactly. So what I encourage my students as well as my clients to reframe. Remember like the seesaw when we were playing as kids, and sometimes like you jump and you want your friend to be thrown off on the other side, or their butt raises up, and it's a constant two forces opposed to one another. What I encourage my clients to do and the teams that we do workshops with is look at it as work-life weaving your work life together, weaving it. And that implies that oneness. It's that oneness. It's a weave. And I tell you, some of the biggest breakthroughs that I've had with client teams as we've done, innovation workshops or team building workshops or strategy workshops is I'll pull some rock and roll song out of my head. I play electric guitar too, and I'm, aspiring, to be in a band. And like that one song, like when I was with a major media company, we were doing a workshop with about $1 billion of business in the room. And what we found was there was these two teams that really didn't know each other or work well together, and they really needed to innovate given all of the disruption in media. So the theme that came through was that Aerosmith song, Come Together Right Now. And so as I was talking with the client about that, it's like, it's all about coming together. And he's like, yeah. And we started singing it. And I realized that the client also, he's actually in a real band that performs. Didn't know that about him because that was compartmentalized in my dialogue with him because he was bringing his business face to our meetings. And we had a huge connection. And then that became the theme of a day-long workshop with basically, $1 billion of executives. And we had the theme, we had the songs, and we made stickers and all kinds of, cool things. And so that is, what I mean about weaving work life together, weaving it together. It's a beautiful weave. It's a tapestry rather than balance. Because if you see it as balance, one will be frustrated forever. Because what do you do when you're driving? Am I in the workspace? Am I on that side, or am I in the personal side if I'm listening to Tamara's podcast?
Right, right.
Am I doing work when I listen to her, or am I, learning to be a better person, or am I just enjoying myself? So when we think about it as a weave rather than a balance, it fundamentally shifts everything about our ability to be great leaders and be great innovators.
That's I love it. It's fantastic. And I think the other thing that I want listeners out there really thinking about too is, I think, Paresh, part of what you're saying, the benefit of that weaving in your work and life is that you create more trust and more relationships. And I think business and innovation in particular are really built on being able to be vulnerable and trusting the person. And that happens when you know them wholly and not, just parts of them.
Exactly. And so what I encourage your listeners to do is find those remote corners of your being that you love, that gets you really excited and get your adrenaline flowing and make your eyes get wide, and shine a light on that. It's really, really cool. I never thought there'd be a place for like a heavy metal headbanger in boardrooms. And right. I'm not saying I will do that in boardrooms, but often like through inspiration, and as you said, if you tap into your emotions, you go, you know what, there's some click here. I was at a conference once, and there was this older gentleman, very conservative, had the red tie on and the Brooks Brothers suit. And he ran one of the major research institutions to address a major disease in the world. And you think he'd be like a super serious, medical doctor and all that. And we were at this place called the Festival of Storytelling. And somehow, and I can't even recall how it happened, we had a connection over a Judas Priest concert that we both went to in like 1985. Awesome. And then he kept sending me all these emails like, Paresh, look, here's someone doing a cover of it. And that was that was vulnerable, right? To bring up Judas Priest at a, you know, when we're talking about, you know, solving a major disease. But then through that connection, we've actually dug, you know, deeply into, you know, what, how might we be able to apply some of these innovation frameworks and theories around, you know, solving big problems. And that's what I'm, you know, here to do, is solve big problems in the world. Ultimately, that's why you're here, is innovation is about solving problems or creating new possibilities, which is the other way I would frame it with my clients is, you know, innovation is about solving problems. And frankly, the world is not all about problems. And there's a whole other side to it, which is about seeing, pursuing, and creating and materializing, manifesting opportunities.
Well, and I think if we look at some of the things that we love, I'm just going to take it to kind of a my everyday life for a moment. I don't think they were problems I had that someone solved. Like if I look at Netflix, I'm not sure they solved a problem. I could rent movies. That's fine.
Exactly.
You know, but I binge watch all the time, all the streaming. But, you know, that's my dirty secret right there. That's the other part. There's my compartment that I usually shut off from people. I'm a total binge watcher. You know, I love CrossFit. I'm huge into CrossFit. But I don't think it solved a problem for me. It turned out to be something I love, but it was an opportunity. And so I think you're right about that. I think it's particularly in innovation, we tend to focus on what's the problem I'm solving. Versus kind of what's the opportunity I can create. And that's a little bit, actually, I think a little bit more forward thinking as well.
It's way more, Tamara, because if you think about the problem you're solving, you've already constrained it in terms of the definition of the problem versus possibilities are unconstrained. And I think, you know, one of the things you rightly talk about in your innovation work and training is, you know, empowering workers with knowledge around innovation rather than, you know, throwing all these processes and tools towards them. And when you empower them with the sort of the knowledge of the sort of the underpinning of it, then you unbound possibilities, and problems are usually framed in a very narrow construct. Yes.
Yeah. You know, two things to what you're saying. One is you're right. I mean, if I look, I'm going to go back to Blockbuster and Netflix for a second because I mentioned binge watching. But the problem that they would have solved for is late fees. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's very narrow at the end of the day. That really was my only issue, right?
Exactly.
At the time.
Versus, hey, I want to binge watch. Like that was not a problem.
No, that wasn't even something we said.
Right? That was not a problem that people are like, oh my God, I so need this. I mean, the world is going to be.
I know. I need to watch 8 episodes of this right now. It's so funny. A friend of mine just texted me before we got on about what she should binge watch this weekend. And I gave her 3 documentaries. I was like, oh my God, this is ridiculous.
But hey, binge watching documentaries is a different thing. I would put that in a different category. My first binge watch was 24, and I used to like end at like 11:45 at night, an episode, and it'd be like da-dun, da-dun, da-dun. And then I would go, oh my God, I have 15 minutes. Can I race to Blockbuster and get the next one?
Oh my gosh.
And I would race. And so that wasn't a problem in the sense, I mean, I guess it was, which I really
wanted
to.
Well, you couldn't imagine the alternative, right? Like we couldn't at that time imagine streaming.
Exactly.
So how would we even know? And just to go to your point about the kind of like starting with the people, I mean, you're absolutely right. Our entire focus at Launch Street is all about human innovation and how do we, and I think you're really kind of in line with that, with what you're talking about being an intersection being. It's really about how do we innovate? How do we bring that to the table? The processes are a dime a dozen and they come and go. And frankly, you can have the best process in the world, but if the people in the room aren't being kind of whole the way you're talking about and don't recognize how they innovate, it really doesn't matter what process you have.
No doubt. No doubt.
I wanted to ask you a question. I read something that you wrote and the number caught me off guard. So I wanted to ask you about it. It said you wrote 88% of leaders need innovators in their organizations. And I thought the 88% of leaders was a fascinating way to frame it. So talk to me about where that came from and what do you mean by needs innovators in their organization?
Okay, so there's a bunch of studies, and you know, there's zillions of studies out there. There's some studies from McKinsey and PwC and various other research, and I've kind of melded a variety of studies together to blend it and to basically what I see as well, which is 88% of leaders are unhappy with the pace of innovation in their organization. They're unhappy.
So they think it's too slow. I'm assuming.
Oh, it's not happening.
Yeah,
it's too slow. They don't. And the counterpoint to that is over the next 5 years, most of the large companies expect over 50% of their revenue to come from new products, services, and experiences like in the next 5 years. So that's a huge gap, which is, okay, half of our business relies on innovation, and we are very unsatisfied with the pace and the quality of the innovation that we have. And it's everyone is afraid of being disrupted, which is a whole other point, which is this fear of disruption and this paranoia, while good and motivating. One of the things, and I'm working with heads of innovation and leaders, is we need to dispel this notion of being afraid of being disrupted. One motivated by fear is not as charged as one motivated by passion or possibility. For instance, you ran Tough Mudder 3 times, right?
Yeah.
Were you motivated by fear that you wouldn't be able to do a Tough Mudder, or were you motivated by something else, Tamara?
I'm usually not motivated by – I mean, I was afraid every time I got to a new obstacle, but I was motivated the first time to just even be able to complete it. And then the second 2 times, I was motivated by improving my performance.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wanted to crush it and beat
exactly.
my time. Yeah.
Exactly. So if we are – in our so many organizations are concerned, and they've been, rightly catalyzed or sparked into thinking about innovation. So there's nothing wrong with it. But folks like Andy Grove, I bow to him. He's amazing. Around Only the Paranoid Survive, and my friend Clay Christensen, who was doing his PhD when I was in business school, around disruption, have created this consciousness, not. Knowingly, where people are like, oh my God, we're afraid we're going to get wiped out by that new disruption. And that's a good lens to have. However, from the work we do with companies, that's not the best motivator. The best motivator is what motivated you to go back to the Tough Mudder and go back again. And you weren't concerned that, Paresh is going to come and disrupt you and beat you. No, you are self-motivated. So that's what we create with the teams we work with, is that self-motivated passion towards possibilities and bringing out the intersection being within people, which, intersection being, if we really call it what it is, it's diversity, right? It's diversity. And that's what Kelly McDonald was talking about in her talk with you.
Yeah, she's fantastic, isn't she? I loved her podcast on diversity and thinking. And it's interesting how it keeps coming up, just that concept, right, of, having different perspectives. And one of the things I kind of often talk about is ideas that come from a birds of a feather tend to die. But the ones that have a diverse group of birds, right, tend to thrive. Like it's really true, and we've seen it all the time. From your perspective, why is diversity and inclusion the secret sauce to creativity? I mean, we're touching on it a little bit, but I'd like to go a little bit deeper. I know you talk about that at the Lifter Leadership Academy, and you obviously live it. So, and in fact, if you have an example here, that would be awesome, of like how that diversity and inclusion led to better business and innovation.
The words diversity and inclusion and the various initiatives that companies have, rightly so, again, the way that they are framed don't unlock the potential for the individuals who are affected by that or for the organizations that can benefit from that. So I'm going to kind of walk back into, so we do a lot of work in diversity and inclusion. However, if we have two choices, which is, hey, come to a workshop on diversity, come to a workshop on inclusion, like how does that make you feel? And you talked about bringing your emotions to work. A lot of the work we do around innovation is tapping into our feeling consciousness along with our, our left brain practical. How do we make money? Because obviously our companies need to thrive. But right. So how does it make you feel to go, hey, Tamara, we're having a workshop tomorrow. Drop all your work and we're going to do a workshop on diversity or inclusion. It's kind of, how does it make you feel?
Well, the reality is it makes me roll my eyes a little bit because it sounds like an HR mandate. And
exactly.
I am 100% for diversity inclusion in the workplace in a lot of levels. But when I think that language now in particular has got some stigma around it.
Exactly. And again, we create in language, as you know, like the language we use actually informs the context and the way we frame the way we see the world and our actions and our behavior. So when we talk about diversity, or when a client says, hey, we need to, take some action around diversity or inclusion, that sort of thing. One of the suggestions we have is, hey, let's start with innovation. Okay.
And interesting.
And let's talk about an evolution, because it used to be, hey, we need to tolerate diversity a while back, right? It's about tolerating. Then it moved to honoring diversity and inclusion. And what we are about is not that. It's, hey, let's activate it. Let's activate it. This is secret sauce. This is the jewels. When you bring in people who have experiences that are so far afoot from what your traditional road would be, that they will bring in perspectives that are just, so valuable. So diversity inclusion to me is the secret sauce for innovation, not because it's diversity inclusion, because these are people who, when we talk about intersection being, people who have diverse perspectives, diverse backgrounds, ethnicities, religions, gender preferences, whatever it might be, they are bringing a whole different angle with which to view the opportunity or the problem. And that angle, when we teach yoga and meditation, it's really about around awareness and self-awareness and awareness of the world around us, what's happening with our teams, what's happening in the market environment. And when someone comes in with a different angle with which to shine a light on a problem or an opportunity, like that is the greatest gift an organization can have. So to me, diversity inclusion is really the most powerful raw material to innovate, whether it's diversity and inclusion, like diversity of thinking from the people who are customarily in your organization, or bringing in people from so far afoot who can just turn the entire problem into an opportunity.
Hello, Launch Street. I am here once again with Derek, who is the president of Brility, and he's going to throw some wisdom bombs on us. So, Derek, here's my question. As a president of Brility, you interact with clients across a whole range of industries. What have you seen across the industries are the biggest challenges facing business growth today?
Hi, Tamara. That's a great question. The biggest challenge, without a doubt, is a concept we refer to as liquid turf. The dynamic environment of business right now moves at an exceptional pace. We have technology that's changing. We have business forces that are changing. We have regulation, international competition. The rate and pace of change is dizzying. And then add to that a lack of time and money and resources. It's quite challenging right now.
So here's my question about that, though. I mean, wouldn't a smart strategy help you manage change?
That's exactly correct. What we find, however, is people don't really understand strategy. They have goals and aspirations, and they have a detailed to-do list and a plan. A strategy is something really between those two. I mean, it's interlocking concepts that have compounding effects that are based on research. And most importantly, Tamara, the strategy is a living, breathing thing. It needs to be dynamic and adaptive to the future. And that's where we come in with our digital approach. We build systems that adapt the strategy as the market changes, as we learn more, as your business objectives may expand or contract. That's really is the key.
So how does Brility, how does your company help solve those challenges for your clients?
That's another great question. We will sit down. We go over the objectives of the client as well as their current thinking and momentum. And then we do what's called a digital presence assessment, where we map out all of the different technologies and market forces that could inform our strategy on how to achieve those objectives. And we present the client with the options. And from there, we can collaborate and make informed plans and decisions, as well as a coherent action plan.
So, Derek, this might be a naive question, but why is a digital platform so important to strategy and growth today?
Well, that's a great question. It is the the immediacy and the granularity of the feedback, we are able to learn so rapidly and adapt so rapidly if everything is set up correctly, that the best way to keep up with the pace of the marketplace is both to grab opportunities as well as to handle challenges is through the digital platforms.
All right, Launch Street, I'm going to go, first of all, make sure that I have a dynamic strategy and not a set in stone goal. And I would hope that you would all do the same now that Derek has helped me understand the difference. Derek, thank you so much for coming by today.
Thank you.
So I am 100% on board with what you're saying. And bear with me as I try to frame up the question I have for you, which is, I think, Certainly. The next step to this. And I truly could not agree more that, you know, diversity is the key to success. First of all, it's more interesting, so we'll just start there. But second, I think also it is what strengthens ideas in business. And like I said, when birds of a feather come together, we all see it the same way and we miss something big. We always do. So here's what I've seen happen. I'd love to hear how you handle this with your clients and help them over this hurdle. So we agree that this is true and we pull ourselves together in a room, but because we aren't coming from that perspective, our confirmation bias or, you know, where we kind of like what we already agree with, kind of comes into play, or we're just not sure how to handle the debate because they see it totally differently. How do you help them through that hump of taking the, yeah, we agree this is a gem, and all right, now we've got to deal with the fact that maybe there's going to be a little bit of friction because we are coming from different perspectives?
So the question is, how do we help the client overcome that resistance to this other perspective?
Yeah, and really implement kind of tapping into that gem that you're talking about, that secret sauce.
Often, I'm going to start with like the most rational perspective, which is, you know, data and outcomes speak super loudly. So I'll give you an example for that. So if we want to, you know, again, we part of what I enjoy doing is traversing the, okay, let's be totally practical, logical, quantitative, because I'm an engineer, I'm an MBA. I love that stuff too. I'm a junkie for that, as well as this other stuff, which is, you know, kind of the softer side is what we would call it. So for instance, I gave a keynote recently at a major telecom cable company. A friend of mine invited me to give this talk. And the night before, I was, you know, coordinating with her, and she runs accessibility at this major company that everybody would know. And the night before, I was in touch with her and I said, hey, I just want to coordinate tomorrow, technical requirements. Do you want me to send your folks my PowerPoint or bring it on a USB stick? And she goes, whatever you want, Presh. I've seen you do it a million times. You're awesome. But just FYI, 70% of your audience tomorrow, Presh, is going to be blind.
Oh.
It's blind. It's her team. Her team, it runs accessibility. So they make the programmable menus on your set-top boxes. They do the remote controls. They do the apps. They do the things required so that people of all capabilities can access these services. And to me, that was like, wow. Cause so, you know, Tamara would say, I'll try anything you want. So
that is true.
So to me, that was very exciting. At first I was a little scared because I had my PowerPoints that I'm so accustomed to using as, you know, a tool. But it was only a fleeting moment because my friend who I trust, we talked about trust. She was like, Presh, I trust you. So I said, hey, Megan, what if I were to just blow up all the PowerPoints and let's do this for blind people? And she's like, oh, that would be epic. And so one of the first things we did was I said, so, you know, you see how innovation can really change the game. And if you can visualize, and I said, okay, pause. You see, I'm already using the words see, visualize.
Yeah.
So this is the unconscious bias that you spoke about coming through. So there, she has a super bright young man. He's blind. He was actually blinded in the Chernobyl nuclear accident.
Yeah.
And he was in Russia. Super smart. He's actually, I'm co-mentoring him to be a speaker because he's amazing. And I said, so I need someone to keep me on. You know, whenever you see me, and he raised his hand, he goes, you did it just now. I said, exactly. Whenever I make a reference to, you know, the ability to see, visualize, picture this, I want you to raise your hand. And he caught me so many times and we had a lot of fun. You know, he was jabbing me. And what we found from the data perspective is we have, you know, this is diversity.
Yeah.
And the data side, when we research true innovation, is if a product or service or experience is designed to be accessible from the very beginning, rather than an add-on at the end, which is my kids love those new Coke machines. Frankly, not my kids. I love them more than they do. You know those Coke machines where you can put a little bit of orange Fanta with a little cream soda?
My kids just call it a mix-up. That's what they order. Like, I'd like a mix-up, please. They don't even call the soda.
Love it. I'll play with that all day. And my kids and then my son pointed out that they had some buttons at the very bottom. He said, "Hey, Dad, check this out. This is for people in wheelchairs." And they had two buttons and they were able to navigate. You know how we push on those little dots?
Yeah.
But there was a way for them to navigate. At the same time, it wasn't an experience that seemed to have been designed from the very beginning. The research shows that if you design something from the very beginning to be accessible to broad audiences, it will be a better design for everybody.
So that's what you're doing in teams and meetings and companies. You're making it accessible from the beginning.
Exactly. So when I say accessibility, it doesn't necessarily mean blind or handicapped.
Right.
It's accessible to anyone, whatever their diverse perspective is. And so when you bring in people with diverse perspectives, diverse backgrounds, and, you know, include them, it's celebrate them. The ideas that come, oh my God, they're off the charts that one would not have when we're typically in that narrow channel that is often defined by the confirmation bias. Often
right.
We have this unconscious bias. You see, and then the guy would raise his hand, and you know, they throw something at. I say, "Throw something at me" every time I make a visual like that. So, this diversity and inclusion are words that are very charged these days. And to me, it's ultimately bring in people who bring in remote corners of perspective on life, remote corners of perspective on life, people who've, you know, been through things, who have, you know, had just all different values. There are people we work with who will question fundamental values sometimes in organizations when given the permission, when the vulnerability threshold has been crossed, as we build trust with the teams at first, and people are able to speak and go, "Hey, you know what? Why are we doing it this way? You know, when I was a kid, we used to do it this way back in my hometown in this remote part of the world." And that opens up a click often.
Yeah, you know,
to speak.
Yeah, I think, you know, what you were just saying just now, you're kind of saying it quickly, but it's so important about the trust and the vulnerability. And we mentioned it before, but it is amazing to me how many teams don't have that. And I do believe that part of that, as we were saying before, is really because we stay a little bit guarded and we put on a little bit of a mask, particularly at work, for all the obvious reasons, right? We don't want to look stupid. We want to look smart. We, you know, want to look like we know what we're talking about. We want to be the cool one in front of our boss, whatever it is. And when we pull that away, we have much more room for innovation. And, you know, I actually want to this is a good segue to go back to something you said earlier, but I think it applies here. You had talked about when you do that, when you bring in those remote parts of yourself, when you have that vulnerability and trust, you also know that you're going to mess up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that, because I think that's the part most of us are afraid of.
I don't want to talk about it. I'm past. So as you start so I'm going to talk about my own experience, and people can draw their own conclusions because everyone is their own vessel. So I operated most of my career from that left brain, you know, engineer,
right, analytical.
And that served me very well. And my parents are very proud of Paresh, which is very good resume. And then I found these other doors opening up, which had been latent for, you know, decades. And I go back and I think about my childhood. And I'm like, oh, that was all there before. I just started closing those doors because of the reasons you pointed out, Tamara, which is, oh, I don't want to look stupid. I might be embarrassed.
Yeah.
You know, no one does that in engineering school. You know, no one does that in business school. So one of the things your listeners will find, it's a little bit of an adrenaline game here, is as you start opening these doors, there's wonders behind these doors. There are wonders behind these doors. And sometimes we love going into these new chambers. And if it's a pendulum, sometimes we swing wildly from one side to another. So many years ago, when I started getting deeply into yoga, meditation, mindfulness, and bringing ancient wisdom, to modern business, and combining it with quantum physics and neuroscience and all this cool stuff that's all like blending together now, which is totally cool, is, and my kids sort of saw it. We were living in Paris at the time. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, dad, who's, you know, typically in his, you know, suit and tie and blue shirt and all that stuff going to clients, you know, he's in his living room doing yoga in like baggy pants, wearing crystals, and, you know, lighting incense. And it's like, what's up with dad? And we start playing in these new worlds. And sometimes we go a little far on the one side, a little far on the other side. And it takes some time to establish an equilibrium where we feel comfortable in these different rooms. And sometimes we're like, wow, there's this whole new part of me that I can self-express, and clients love it. So then you kind of sometimes go too far, and then, you know, you go, oh, wait a minute, I went a little too far. So that is a process that, you know, took a couple of years, and now we're kind of, you know, we're interwoven now as a nice tapestry. So my advice to your listeners is find those remote chambers that are latent, dormant, waiting to open up wonders, 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 and play in them. Play, play, play. And know that, you know what, you're going to swing a little bit this way, a little bit this way. And all of a sudden, you know, like, maybe I should be a rock and roll singer and give up, you know, being a consultant and trainer. And then you go, well, Paresh, and, you know, my wife will remind me, you know what, you're not quite Eddie Van Halen yet.
Not yet, Paresh. Not yet.
It's your job.
I want to bring it to you personally, and you've kind of started to allude to it. And, you know, you took the IQE, the assessment, so I know what your results are, you know. But just in your words, I'd love to hear how you innovate, how you do that.
First of all, I cannot stand that word, and I'm just going to declare that. It's
Which
so
one?
Overused, innovation.
I think it has different meanings for everybody.
How do I create? How do I create awesomeness in my life, in the lives of the people around us, and great performance? And it's just been overused. There's nothing, you know, inherently wrong about it. Innovate comes from the etymology of it means to make new, which I love. Like, innovate means to make new. So some of the things that I personally do in order to be innovative for my clients that activate that being within me are, I surf, I'm learning to surf, and going into the ocean and nature is very powerful to be inspired and to, this client's struggling with this issue here, and they've got this context of, you know, a boss who's, you know, really difficult, and we got to deal with it, and they've got this market shift that's happening. And so, you know, clearly there's the rational way of looking at it with five forces and different, you know, all the standard, you know, practical business theories and analyses. But going in nature, often I find just like something will click. My favorite way of getting into the space of innovation or the space of creative problem solving is I get into my 77 Nova. It's green. And I drive up and down Vista Del Mar along the ocean here in Los Angeles, cranking tunes as loud as anyone's ears could possibly bear at midnight to 1 a.m. And I just drive up and down. I have a little notebook with a magic marker on the seat next to me. Or sometimes I use my, I've got two phones, and I use Temi, which is a recording. I use my recorder on my phone, and then something will come and I'll be inspired to think of another song, and I'll just put it on. And then great things flow. So music for me activates that space, and it breaks down those doors and brings down those walls, which can combine sort of technology and business and mindfulness and innovation and creativity and intuition and neuroscience. Movement through either, I love dancing. I met my wife at a dance 37 years ago. I love dancing. I love flowing through life. Sometimes I will just take an Uber somewhere randomly and just start walking and see what happens. And it's amazing. Like someone will just show up and go, hey, you know what? I mean, for instance, I was just at South by Southwest this last weekend. I was getting into this lift and the driver, he was just an amazing guy. He goes, hey, I have that same belt buckle. I'm like, what has that same belt buckle? He goes, 1977, Styx, the Cornerstone album. And I was like, yes. And it was a belt buckle I had from 1977. And it's this big Styx belt buckle. And it was like this amazing connection. And so then we actually just drove around. I'll drive around with Uber drivers who I have a connection with. And we just jam and great ideas come. Because when you're in the space of being a lifter, which are the best innovators, what we find is you will attract the answers. You don't need to pursue them. You don't need to go after them, which is how we've been wired on the left side Western mind is, hey, I got to go solve this. Let me apply my critical thinking in my brain to solve it, which is partly true. However, one of the things we talk about, and I've got this TEDx talk that explains it, is this new model of leadership, lifter leadership, solves the four biggest problems companies have, which is the need for to be innovative and disruptive, and lifters are the best innovators. Lifters build trust and loyalty better than anyone because they're authentic and they have integrity and a variety of other things. Lifters are the most motivated and the most motivating leaders. And as you know, 7 out of 10 workers today are unengaged, according to the Society of Human Resources Management. And lifters know how to align purpose with output. And so what we found is that if you equip people to kind of move into that space of who they are, all kinds of magic happens. And so one of the things I say is that when I was at Harvard Business School, I learned to be very effective at hunting for customers, targeting them, capturing them, segmenting you, Tamara, so that I could analyze you, so that I could have my share of your wallet and no one else could. So that's been a mindset around the globe for hundreds of years around how we do business. We pursue, we hunt, we capture, transact. And what lifters realize, because we're creating a whole new world right now and it's happening right now, lifters realize that if you're attuned in a certain way, and we teach you how to do this, we teach leaders how to do this, that you don't need to hunt, target, capture, pursue customers, no, or even opportunities. You attract them. You inspire customers. You serve. And ultimately, you lift people. And when you lift people with positivity and purpose, and authenticity, integrity, help them be vulnerable in who they are, help them shine light and support them in these compartmentalized rooms that they often, you know, feel that are, you know, not permissioned, then it's magic. And this is where that mindfulness, this sort of self-help, spirituality, and the wisdom work comes through, is things just show up. And so I'll be like, hey, I need some inspiration. And then boom, the driver who picks me up in Uber has the answer. And we just drive around. I say, great, just drive around. Let me just put an address that's like, you know, 10 miles from here and, you know, go around the coast and then magic happens. So those are some of the ways I innovate, is I just go with the flow. I listen to music. I get in my car and I drive. I basically find things I love. I go to the studio and just play music as loud as I can. My kids can't stand how loud I play the music. And basically attuned to that. The other thing that some of my business partners and I do, and we encourage all of our clients to do this, is when you go to the bookstore, get 5 magazines that you would never, ever, ever, ever get, and go through them. Look at the pictures. Read a couple of articles you would never, ever, ever, ever read. So for instance, you know, I'll get Ink. But it's not INC, it's INK. It's a tattoo magazine. Okay, Hispanic Mother. Okay. Would I ever really buy Hispanic Mother magazine? Probably not. And it gives you these other perspectives, right? That's what it's about. So that's one of the things that put yourself into rivers and flows of thinking, flows of being that you ordinarily wouldn't do, and say, hey, wow, you know what? Let's get, you know, teen magazine, and because, you know, a teeny bopper girl magazine, and say, what's happening? Well, how are they speaking to one another? What are the ads? What's working? What's the dialogue look like? And it's really amazing what can come through. And sometimes you end up being all the Spice Girls. Right.
Oh my gosh. Look how you looped it back to the beginning. Well played. That was great. I was like, oh my God, he just did that. I have to say it's interesting that the pick up the magazines has been a funny theme of the day. I've done three interviews today and all of us have mentioned that in some way, including myself. I was talking about how I wish the grocery store had the, you know, they don't have the magazines they used to. So it used to be that you could sit and read them while you were kind of waiting for checkout. I mean, it was fantastic. Now you got to go to a bookstore really to get all the magazines. But what I mostly appreciate about what you're saying is, and this is really that collaborative inquisitive, which is your archetype in you. Collaborative is all about finding yourself at the intersection of random, collecting disparate pieces and dots of things and putting them together. And the inquisitive is the curious side, right? You innovate in the questions, not the answers, which is, I think, why you're probably so willing to just go drive, right? You're like, I'm just going to sit and be curious for a while and see what it takes. And what you said about in those moments is when those kind of ideas come to you, I think we can all kind of, as we're listening, think of a moment where we weren't thinking about the problem or work, and that's when the idea came to us, right? It's like, ooh, when you're washing dishes, right? Or taking a shower, or taking a hike or whatever. It's always in those moments that when you're just open to it, but not really expecting it.
No doubt, no doubt, because that is when the great flow happens. And of course, I would be remiss to say, how do I serve clients the best, and how do I really innovate? The other major tool is sit still, meditate, sit still. And when I say meditate, that doesn't mean, you know, and doing mantras and all that necessarily, although that they have their own power. It's be still and don't do anything. Don't think of anything. If it's bird watching, bird watch. If you're fishing, fish. If you're weaving, weave, and just be still and be in the moment. I encourage a lot of my students, like, Paresh, I can't meditate. My thoughts are always going. I'm like, you know what? That's your first problem, is you've created that for yourself. Can you just sit still for 10 seconds? Yeah, I can do that. Okay, great. You can meditate. And then make it 11. Then make it a minute. And then soon you'll be able to meditate for 2.5 hours and sit still and just be there. Now, my logical brain many years ago would say, what a freaking waste of time sitting still for 2.5 hours when you have this whole to-do list, Paresh. Are you out of your mind? And my response is, yes, I am out of my mind, because your mind is not where all the great magic happens. It's in that other space. There's a Gandhi quote, which I love. And I reminded myself of it this morning, because today's a huge day of so much to do, disproportionate to most days. And my wife is away with one of our kids. So I'm Mr. Mom, Mr. Dad, and I'm going away for a conference at 4 a.m. tomorrow. And literally, I'm like, oh my God, there's so much to do. And I get to talk with tomorrow. It's going to be great. And then the quote came to me with that little smart little, Gandhi, the little Gandhi cute little face, saying, the quote is, something like, today is a very, very busy day, so I will meditate for 2 hours instead of one.
I think it's so funny, as you were talking earlier, it's exactly what I was thinking about. I couldn't remember the quote, but I remember it's, if you're busier, meditate more, basically, is what it boils down to.
And I tell you, any of your listeners who go, that's a bunch of crock of shit, excuse my language, I get you. I was that guy going, you've got to be kidding me. You're going to sit still and things are going to get done? How is that possible? Let me tell you, with great data behind this, through practice. And I really have to tell you, so that you all can remind me, if you bump into me on the street and I look like I'm a little frazzled, you can say, hey, Paresh, remember what Gandhi said.
Go meditate.
When we sit still, the answers come faster, clearer. The number of iterations required to get things done are ridiculously lower, and the beauty, magic happens there when we do this. And I cannot explain why. It's just, you know, call it the force, call it spirit, call it the universe. I have days where when I truly kind of get into the space, go out to the ocean in the morning, do some swimming, you know, attempt to surf, come out, do some meditation, 5 or 6 things off of my to-do list will simultaneously get wiped out and done. And I don't have to do anything, which seems illogical. And that's what it is. I'm out of my mind. And there's a whole other space that we are in when we're great innovators. And we can teach people to do this. You don't even need to learn how to meditate to do this. There are skills and techniques that we train people in to tap into this font of answers and creativity.
It's awesome. I'll tell you, I meditate pretty much every day. Sometimes I fall asleep while I do it, but I always do it.
Fantastic.
And I used to feel really guilty. I usually do it around 2 or 3 o'clock because that's my lull time. So if I do it then, I find myself super productive the rest of the day. I'm good in the mornings.
Some people take naps and meditation is, you know, in a way it kind of recharges you.
Sometimes I fall asleep. I'm not going to lie. Sometimes I crash. I get up at 4 a.m. So sometimes by 2, 3, I'm like, oh, I need a nap. Usually it's about 30 minutes. That's usually fantastic. My time frame. Yeah. And then I'm back at it. But it's so funny because I used to feel really guilty about it. Like I should be doing something. Mm-hmm. But really, as I started to look at, you know, my to-do list and not just checking stuff off my to-do list, but the quality of the work, it went up when I took that break. So I started taking that break almost every day in some way or another. Before I ask you the last question, where can people go to learn more and connect with you?
Okay, just go to iamalifter.com/InsideLaunchStreet. I am a lifter. I'm sure your listeners are lifters. And again, lifters are positive, purposeful people who uplift their coworkers, uplift their customers, uplift their community, and therefore uplift their companies. And so they're the most innovative leaders that companies are creating now. And so if you go to iamalifter.com, iamalifter.com/InsideLaunchStreet. You can, there's a variety of resources there. Number one, we have an assessment, kind of like you have on yours, on your lifter leadership capabilities. There's a TEDx talk. So if you feel you're a lifter, check it out. And if it resonates with you, know that you are and move into that groove, because I'm telling you, lifters are the future leaders of this planet, not the future, now. Companies realize that's what they need. And we actually have, you know, of course I do keynotes and training and workshops, but we actually are created an online curriculum now because a lot of small businesses and entrepreneurs and individuals want to have this type of leadership so they can motivate their workers and be innovative and build trust and loyalty. And so we have an online curriculum, and we'll give Friends of Tomorrow a special peek if you come to iamalifter.com/InsideLaunchStreet on, you know, lifter leadership. And I've got a book coming out, which we'll give your folks a free little glimpse up as it comes through. Yeah, you're such a lifter, Tamara. I really love what you're doing. And yeah.
Well, thank you. It has been a pleasure having you on. It's been a bit of a wild ride, but in a really good way. So thank you.
No worries. So any way that I can be of service to you, let me know. And to all of your listeners out there, you know, just know that find those remote rooms and go back to your childhood and think about what you love. Ask your parents, what did I do? What did I love? And, you know, my parents are like, you would go play with caterpillars in the woods for hours and hours. And it's like, okay, well, how does that have bearing on how I can bring value to the CEOs and the teams that I work with? And there's always a jewel there. There's always a jewel. And if you don't know where it is, do as Tamara does. Sit still and just be and watch the magic unfold.
Okay, here's my question for you. Are you a lifter? Actually, that's the wrong question. I know that you are. So maybe the better question is, are you intentionally using it? Do you engage in lifting activities every day? What do you say we go lift some other people? Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Lawn Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Lawn Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.